At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the DD Geopolitics live stream. I am your host. Curtis is back from Venezuela. And we will talk all about that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It was a great trip. I just got back just a few hours ago. Happy to be home, but also lots to update you all on.
We will get to that. That will be our last segment. Obviously, today we're going to talk about the relationship falling apart between Putin and Trump. Lots of disappointment on Trump's side. The weird West Bank annexation and the cruise trip to the Levant and the Gulf. And obviously, Chris's Venezuela trip and an update on Latin America in general. What was your favorite thing about your trip to Venezuela, especially given the news? What was going on?
I mean, it had to be the resilience of the people and their dignity. I mean, nothing's stopping them. Okay, yes, people are a little bit nervous, but they are very much with their country, patriotic. Even if they disagree with the government on certain policies and issues, everyone is rallying behind the flag and saying, no gringo is going to come here and take our country from us again. So. And that was really, was really great. Of course, it was also great to see Maduro dancing, President Maduro dancing and, hugging kids and, hanging out.
Don't give away all the spoilers. That's the last.
I'm sorry. But in any case, it was just great. Overall, it was just fantastic. People are wonderful. Food's great. Sunshine plus rain. It was all good. I can't complain.
Perfect. Well, I can complain. And so can Trump. So let's
see. I'll bring you next time.
This week, then I won't complain anymore. If I get to go to Venezuela, I won't complain for a while. But this week, Mark Rutte made a trip to the White House. Of course, the big topics were Ukraine and obviously NATO. And Trump seemed like he doesn't really know what to make of Putin. Here's what he said.
Well, I think that in terms of honesty, the only thing I can say is every time I speak with Vladimir, I have good conversations, and then they don't go anywhere. They just don't go anywhere. So in that sense, but no, look, he's fighting a war.
I have conversations. They seem to go well, but then they just don't go anywhere.
Yeah, well, it's like those dates that sometimes, you just keep on going on those endless dates. And they don't just go anywhere. I guess that's the two of them. Who knows at this point?
I think it's just kind of a confusion on Trump's end in a way. There's another American official that echoed this week, and I can't remember who it was, but he said, Trump and Putin keep having these great conversations. And then immediately after, Putin just bombs Ukraine. And it's like, do you guys not know like what's kind of going on? Like it was like a really, is he hurt by Putin continuing to bomb Ukraine while the talks are still going on?
Well, he's like, let's have a ceasefire. Let's stop the killing. And it's like, yeah, but Russia has said consistently since day one, actually since day zero, we need to address the root causes. Until the root causes are addressed, the military operation continues, and that's just a fact. There's no changing that.
Putin also had a lot to say. I don't remember where this was. It was after some visit he did this week. But here is him talking about, this is in reference to the proposed talks that were supposed to maybe happen in Hungary. Everything seems kind of a fly by night. And I think this is Putin sort of pointing that out.
Now, в последнем телефонном разговоре и сама встреча и место ее проведения были предложены американской стороной. И я согласился с этим, выразил соображения в этой связи и сказал о том, что, безусловно, такие встречи нужно хорошо готовить. И для меня, и для американского президента было бы ошибкой подойти к этому легко и выйти после этой встречи без ожидаемого результата.
So there's that. Also, if you guys noticed that watermark in the top corner, Rena Liu underscore, she's fantastic. She's a Russian historian, lives, I think she's in Moscow, but don't, maybe St. Petersburg, but I'm not one of the major cities. But yes, very great follow. But anyway, so in this clip, Putin, I thought, seemed to be pointing out the lack of sort of planning and kind of getting things in order or even just taking the whole thing seriously, at least from the American side. Not planning appropriately. If our, you might recall, and our, hopefully our viewers do as well, that in Alaska, that meeting was cut short by the Americans.
Correct.
And all reports corroborated after that, that. There were a few that said the Americans looked like they were seeing a ghost. That didn't go very well for the Americans. So maybe there was piss poor planning on their part for the Alaska one. And now they're kind of just throwing out like, oh, let's all just go to Hungary.
And well, there were also reports that Trump raised his voice at that meeting, like in the closed door after the press left, that at some point towards the end of that first session, and then they canceled lunch and everybody left.
Right.
Trump raised his voice and started to get agitated. And that's because they want to have a nice peace deal, sign, ribbon, everything, and have a nice propaganda coup. They don't want to address the root issues, which are, of course, at the core of U.S. and European national security interests. And until you address those, Russia is not going to end its special military operation, nor is it going to end its posture.
So do you think that this is we point this out a lot. Do you think this is another instance of a cultural clash where the Americans are like flying by the seat of their pants? They don't really like think things through. They're like, let's just meet for talks. And the Russians are like, why would we? There's no plan. What's the plan? There's no agenda. What are we talking about?
Yeah, of course. I absolutely think that. I think that, listen, the Americans like to have these photo op opportunities. And the Russians, aside from parades and, you know, memorials and things like that, and giving out medals and orders, they don't like to do that, actually. They want things to be substantive, right? They're okay. There's a time to do the pomp and circumstance, but you can't do that for important meetings with a country that is now considered to be an unfriendly country, at least, but actually is openly arming and supplying intelligence that's killing Russian soldiers and civilians. So that's why I think Putin, in that clip and overall, what you've seen from Putin, Lavrov, Peskov, Zakharova, everybody, has been Russia remains a stable and sober actor. And it wants to address these issues in a methodical, disciplined, and organized way. Not just, we need peace, stop the killing. Okay, yes, we all agree. Everybody agrees on that. But how do you stop the killing? How do you address the issues that led to 2014? How do you stop American interference and NATO interference into these countries? How do you declare Ukrainian neutrality? How do you provide the security guarantees? How do you denazify? How do you do all that stuff? That stuff needs concrete answers. And so far, we don't have any of that.
Right. And then here is Putin responding to the sanctions placed on Russia. So for our viewers, sanctions were placed on Russia. More sanctions were placed on Russia from the Americans and the EU. Another tranche. But this, what Putin says here is really important, because keep in mind, Trump is constantly reminding us that this war would have never happened if he was president. Well, this is what Putin says.
Теперь, что касается новых санкций. Во-первых, ничего нового здесь нет. Да, они для нас носят серьезный, конечно, характер, это понятно. И будут иметь определенные последствия. Но существенно все-таки не скажутся на нашем экономическом самочувствии. Ну, в первую свою итерацию президентскую, известно, что президент Трамп ввел тогда самое большое количество санкций, которые до сих пор, до тех пор вводились против Российской Федерации. Они на сегодняшний день имеют, конечно, два аспекта. И чисто политические, и экономические. Что касается политического, о чем здесь идет речь? Это, конечно, попытка оказать давление на Россию. Но ни одна уважающая себя страна и ни один уважающий себя народ никогда ничего не решает под давлением. И, безусловно, Россия имеет такую привилегию чувствовать себя, считать себя в этом списке уважающих себя стран и народов. Это первое. Второе – это чисто экономическая составляющая. Да, но если говорить о политической части, то, конечно, это акт недружественный в отношении России, это очевидная вещь, и он не укрепляет российско-американские отношения, которые вот только-только начали восстанавливаться. А, конечно, такими действиями администрации США наносит ущерб российско-американским отношениям.
So I think that was important. A few things he pointed out. So the sanctions will be serious. They will have certain effects, but they won't affect our economic well-being. Well, Chris can let us know that they're starving in Moscow. It's like a
scene. Oh, my God. It's, you know, people are eating rats and corpses like they were in Venezuela under U.S. crippling sanctions.
Exactly. But I also thought it was important that Putin pointed out that in his first term, Trump placed the largest sanctions package to date on Russia. And I fact-checked it, and it's true. The largest number. He issued 273 Russian sanctions between 2017 and 2020, the highest total by that point. They penalized Russia's intelligence, military, and energy sectors. During Trump's administration, Russia was sanctioned for election interference, mm-hmm. the annexation of Crimea, and for building Nord Stream 2. Which we all know was later bombed by the Americans, sabotaged by the United States. So in total, 52 major actions impacting hundreds of targets. So when Trump tells you this isn't his war, I think not.
Not only that, I just want to bring people back. The Trump administration from 2017 to 2020 armed, funded, and supplied the Ukrainian regime's military forces, actively trained in the Black Sea and in Ukrainian territory with U.S. Army and Marine and special operators for their equivalent in joint NATO and broader coalition exercises, and continued to provide the necessary capabilities for the Ukrainians to strike at targets within the Donbass. So Trump himself is linked to bloodshed because it was the Americans providing the intelligence, the arms, and the training that allowed for tens of thousands of people to be killed and slaughtered in the Donbass. The Russians don't forget that. And I think that we also shouldn't forget that.
Right. And he also pointed out two aspects, so a political and economic. So the political one I thought was interesting. He says, no self-respecting country or people makes decisions under pressure, and Russia counts itself among those nations. Was he taking a little bit of a jab at the United States?
I think so. I think that's a very diplomatic way of you know, sticking the knife in.
And do you think that he says that the relations have been damaged, that we're on their way towards recovering? Do you think that these relations have been irreparably damaged for the foreseeable future? Do you think this is tone setting, or is the door to diplomacy still wide open as the Russians have kind of stressed?
Listen, Russia will never close the door on diplomacy. Russia never has closed the door on diplomacy. Not even under Stalin was the door of diplomacy closed. Never, ever, ever, ever. Throughout Russia's history, diplomacy has always been at the top. And Russia has a proud centuries-long, if not millennia-long tradition of an extremely robust foreign ministry and diplomatic corps, including foreigners, like the first leader of Free Greece, who was a foreign minister of the Russian Federation. Most people don't even know that. There were Germans who were ministers of the Russian Federation. So I just want people to recognize that Russia never will close the door on diplomacy, but it will tighten and harden its stance on certain issues. And of course, that it will not be as flexible nor as warm about how to deal with some of the underlying issues if these hostilities and unfriendly actions continued, as President Putin indicated. You know, there's never an irreparable harm. And we see right now that Kirill Dmitriev, of course, is in the United States. However, there is, of course, going to be a much more, I think, stern and cold reception to the bipolar nature of U.S. foreign policy, which under the Trump administration seems to change even within the day, you know, hour by hour, minute by minute.
Well, things aren't looking too good because if our viewers recall, Trump almost always gives us a 2-week turnaround time. But this time,
President Putin basically said today that Russia is immune from U.S. sanctions. He said that it would not impact the Russian economy in any serious way. Is he
good.
Wrong?
I'm glad he feels that way. That's good. I'll let you know about it in 6 months from now. Okay, let's see. Let's see how it all works out.
We gotta wait 6 months.
6 months.
We'll revisit this in 6 months. So we'll see you guys in an update on the Putin-Trump relationship in 6 months.
But you know what 6 months, for me, like how I read that? 6 months is a lot of time to sell NATO weapons.
That's a lot of weaponry.
And a lot of things can change in 6 months, especially on the battlefield. And if the battlefield conditions change and Trump doesn't like it, there might be an increase in arms or a loosening of restrictions on some of the U.S. arms supplied.
True.
I think that everybody needs to factor that in with this 6 months type language.
Of course, you knew this wasn't going to come to pass without a comment from Medvedev calling it an act of war, stating they will, of course, say he couldn't help but be pressured in Congress, etc. This doesn't change the main point. The decisions taken are an act of war against Russia, and now Trump has fully aligned himself with insane Europe.
Yep.
I think that's good. I think that it's good to, well, he's kind of always held that line, but I think it's important to keep pointing out that Trump is issuing more sanctions.
Correct. He certainly is.
And speaking of Europe, the EU, they issued their own set of sanctions on Russian toilets.
Запрещены унитазы, игрушки с моторчиками, головоломки, трехколесные велосипеды. Как вы можете все это прокомментировать?
То, что отменили приобретение наших унитазов, это им дорого обойдется. Они им, в общем-то, мне кажется, были бы нужны в сегодняшней ситуации. А если они дальше будут продолжать такую же политику в отношении...
That was my favorite. Oh my God, it was so funny. But by the way, I thought that Russia stole all the toilets from Ukraine anyway. Now they can't sell those toilets back to the EU.
It's crazy, really, that the fact that they put sanctions on toilets, there's so many jokes within, of course, and they go back in time.
It's that they're going to need them. It's going to cost them dearly. They're going to need them.
Absolutely. Back to stinky medieval Europe. There we go.
Speaking of costing people dearly, I have a question for you. This report came out. It was in Reuters first. Actually, I think it came out in some random South China news, maybe one of those. It says China oil majors suspend Russian oil buys due to sanctions. Sources say. The only other thing it says is multiple trade sources said on Thursday. There was never a Russian statement. There was never a Chinese statement. Do we have any update on this whatsoever? I do have a clip, and I'll show you that first, of what China had to say about it.
U.S. 路透社, 特朗普, 政府,
China always opposes unilateral sanctions that has no basis in international law and unauthorized by UN Security Council.
Does China stop buying? I mean, Trump also said India promised to stop buying Russian oil. That never happened. So do you think China will stop buying Russian oil?
Listen, I mean, I've seen the reports similar to you have. We've seen the media reports that somehow there's some sources saying that they are stopping the purchase of Russian oil. If they are stopping the purchase, it's probably stopping the direct purchase, but not the purchase through third parties. So I don't actually think this changes anything. I think that it's basically going to be, okay, we got to add another layer of security, another shell company, another flagship, another some way to get that oil there. But no, I don't think that I was taken aback by the US press and the Western press going wild about this claim without there being any official comment by the Chinese or the Russian authorities. And of course, the only comments that exist, like the one that you played, are simply reinforcing the fact that both Russia and China do not agree with unilateral coercive measures in the form of sanctions. And also that these sanctions are illegal under international law if they don't come from the UN Security Council, which has the authority to sanction countries. If, of course, that is approved by the five permanent members and a majority on the Security Council. So I don't see anything like this at this point. And if it's going to happen, it's going to be a nice way, like India is currently trying to figure out, it's going to be a nice way to sort of bypass the sanctions through third parties.
Yeah, some people said, oh, it'll be seaborne oil. And, you know, when you get rumors like this, they're almost just to kind of cause market volatility. There's nothing, right. There was nothing right. to substantiate this. And even when I searched for it today to even see if we could find an update, it was still like the same five sources that were corroborating this. It's like Bloomberg, Reuters, then like Hindu Times, or it was very random. I don't know how true this is what I'm trying to get at. So yeah, another exactly. reminder, yeah, to take these sort of Western reports on stuff like this, the grain of salt, especially when we have no statements from the countries themselves.
I agree with you.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys, while we're on the topic of the EU and the United States acting aggressively, the usual suspects obviously begin to rear their heads. We've talked about this multiple times as the United States is trying to go back to the old drawing board, the old kind of schemes that used to work. So here's what's going on in Eastern Asia.
Concerning the increase of defense budget of Japan, my response is that due to the history of Japanese aggression, its military and security moves have been closely followed by Asian neighbors and the international community. In recent years, Japan drastically adjusted its security and defense policies, increased defense budget, relaxed export control on weapons, and sought breakthroughs in military buildup. This has led to serious doubts among the international community and Asian neighbors over whether Japan is committed to exclusively defense-oriented policy and the path of peaceful development. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the War of Chinese People's Resistance Against Japanese Aggression and the World Anti-Fascist War. We urge Japan to deeply reflect on its history of aggression, be committed to peaceful development, be prudent in military and security areas, and avoid losing more trust from Asian neighbors and the international community. Next one, please.
Guys, recall, I believe this was from September in Valdai when Putin said this.
Внимательно следим за набирающей силу милитаризации Европы. Просто ли это слова, либо нам пора принимать ответные меры. Вот мы слышим же, и вы знаете об этом. ФРГ, например, говорит о том, что немецкая армия должна быть опять самой мощной в Европе. Ну, хорошо. Мы внимательно это слушаем, смотрим, чего же там, что имеется в виду. Думаю, ни у кого нет сомнений.
What are your thoughts? I mean, we've talked about this before, and now China's making, obviously, an outward statement about the rearming of Japan. Germany, for the viewers that don't know, I highly doubt there's any, but Germany and Japan were basically forced to demilitarize following World War II. Both were occupied by the United States, Japan more so, but yeah, so.
I think, listen, this is a common concern that's ongoing for decades about the possibility of a remilitarization, an increase in fascism and nationalist rhetoric, historical revisionism about the period of the war. And I think that what you're seeing in Germany and Japan now simultaneously is because of the developing multipolar world, because of the close alliance, and I would say the strategic alliance between Russia, China, and by extension, the DPRK, especially in the Pacific theater. I think that Japan, and by the way, Japan has a NATO office, but it's not mm-hmm. like an official one. It's one of those like overseas partner offices. Mm-hmm. But Japan has been touted as a partner with NATO. Of course, it's not in the North Atlantic. It's in the Pacific, for those who don't know geography. But, and I think that the NATO is lacking in that realm. But one of the main important things is that the Russian Federation and before its predecessor, the Soviet Union, as well as the People's Republic of China, have been adamant about their concerns of remilitarization for these two countries that have historically been belligerent and imperialistic in their aims, right? Exactly. And so the rearmament of Germany now that's coming, by the way, from the top down, mm-hmm. it's basically a policy now, as well as in Japan, is of deep concern because they're looking at this and saying, okay, we fought one world war, two world wars, we fought how many different other wars, and now these countries are once again into the fray. I mean, that's very concerning. Of course, it was a concern of Stalin, was a concern of other Soviet leaders. And of course, we have to note that throughout this, you know, past few decades of the European Union's existence, there has been a great concern of a European army led by the German army. And that's what's slowly developing, is Germany is taking the lead with France in tow of a European-wide military formation. And they keep on talking about Ukraine and everything else on the Eastern Front. And they are really focused on this. And the Russians are petrified of this because they know that this ultimately leads to war. And they are trying to ring the alarm bells like they were doing in 2007-08 at Munich, right? But nobody's listening again because everybody's saying this is conspiracy theories and this is Kremlin talking points. And it's like, no, this is just actually historical fact that this has been an ongoing concern since the beginning.
Right. And like you said, these are the non-NATO allies where the United States can always guarantee to cause trouble. So Japan, South Korea, Egypt, Qatar, and Israel are the major non-NATO allies. So for all intents and purposes, they're in NATO just without the privilege of having Article 5 applied to
them. And before Gustavo Petro, Colombia.
And we'll get to him later, too.
If you start to look at this as an architecture of global domination and these networks of power and militarization and bases and this architecture of security, then you understand, well, why is Trump also going after Gustavo Petro now? Maybe there's something there, huh?
Maybe. Well, switching over to the other major non-NATO ally, Israel. The gang landed again because Israel can't, I guess they're not listening or obeying or something. I don't know. Vice President Vance arrived on Sunday. On that same day, coincidentally, whoopsie, the Knesset votes on whether or not to annex West Bank. This is coming after, right, the day he lands. While he's meeting with Netanyahu, the Knesset votes to annex West Bank, and I'll get into more of the details of that in a second. But Donald Trump has repeatedly said that won't happen. Here's J.D. Vance. This is hilarious. It's a bag of mashed potatoes.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll do. Yeah.
The West Bank vote yesterday that took place while you were in the country.
Oh yeah, that was weird. I was sort of confused by that. Now, I actually asked somebody about it, and they told me that it was a symbolic vote, some symbolic vote to recognize or a symbolic vote to annex the West Bank. I mean, what I would say to that is when I asked about it, somebody told me that it was a political stunt, that it had no practical significance. It was purely symbolic. I mean, look, if it was a political stunt, it was a very stupid political stunt, and I personally take some insult to it. The West Bank is not going to be annexed by Israel. The policy of the Trump administration is that the West Bank will not be annexed by Israel. That will continue to be our policy. And if people want to take symbolic votes, they can do that. But we certainly weren't happy about it.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't know that I've ever known the Knesset to go into work on a Sunday to take a symbolic vote. Not to mention they voted. That was not the only thing they voted on. So we'll get to that later. But here, Trump did do an interview with Time Magazine, and he once again addressed this, saying, it won't happen. It won't happen. It won't happen because I gave my word to the Arab countries, and you can't do that now. We've had great Arab support. It won't happen because I gave my word to the Arab countries. It will not happen. Is he like rocking back and forth as he's saying, it won't happen. It won't happen. Israel would lose all of its support from the United States if it happened. Plus, put an X in the chat to doubt, like X for doubt. What world would that? They've been annexing the West Bank for. I can't. Anyway, so Bibi quickly tried to save face. He ran right to X. And he says, the Knesset vote on annexation was a deliberate political provocation by the opposition to sow discord during Vice President's visit. The Likud party and the religious parties, the principal coalition members did not vote on these bills. Now, that is true. They did not. But he was quickly community noted and thrown up a link to a Ynet article that obviously says that the Knesset did vote. And this is after. So Bibi, the bill itself, was proposed by this member of the Knesset named Avi Moaz. Avi Moaz is the single member of the Knesset of the Noam Party. And he proposed this bill, and Netanyahu quickly...
Not the Noam Chomsky Party.
Yeah, spelled the same way. Yeah. So Netanyahu wanted the Knesset to withdraw it just because of the visit. Bad timing, not because of we're not annexing the West Bank. So Noam is a far-right ultra-Orthodox party. It's described as radically Zionist and anti-secular. This party was part of the Netanyahu coalition, but Moaz quit in March. I think it doesn't really go into too much detail, but I think he quit because he was too far to further right than Bibi and the coalition. So Moaz says, it is time to apply sovereignty. The settlements in the land of Israel are our connections to ourselves as a people. We call to immediately apply Israeli law and sovereignty to Judea and Samaria. Since the government has hesitated, it is our duty as Knesset members to do it. Now, Bibi says that his party voted or didn't vote, but Likud member Yuli Edelstein posted on Twitter, I just voted in favor of applying sovereignty over Judea and Samaria, especially now. Israeli sovereignty throughout our homeland is the order of the day. I have fought for the land of Israel all of my life, and I call on Zionist factions to vote in favor. So there's that. Haaretz journalist calls out Netanyahu and says, you're a hopeless, pathetic liar. It was proposed by a member of your government. Well, not technically, no, he was a member of the government. The finance minister and national security minister both supported it. They did. And you just said this week that Israel is not a protectorate and you will behave, and you behave like it certainly is. Interesting, 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 interesting. At the same time, Avigdor Lieberman, you guys might know him, proposed a separate bill focused on an annexation of a major settlement east of Jerusalem. Both bills passed. Both of them passed. So some Likud officials denounced it not because of the contents of the bill, but because it was a reckless maneuver to do this while Vance was in town, and settlers obviously praised the vote. Very interesting. I thought this whole thing was really, really interesting that I don't even know if Likud was really in protest of it or if they were kind of feigning protestation and the whole thing was an affront to Vance.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think so. I mean, listen, nothing happens there without a reason. I believe that strongly.
Correct.
And I believe especially everything is so carefully curated there. This happened. This, we got to think about it in the larger scheme, because we've talked about this. Trump and Netanyahu have at points traded kind of barbs over sort of U.S.-Israel relations.
Right.
And this is a great opportunity for the vice president to come and to have his pants pulled down.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly how I thought of it.
And the reason why is you can go back in time and remember when Netanyahu came to Washington and Obama was not even present, and Netanyahu didn't even see Obama. He came as a foreign head of state to the U.S., went to Congress, addressed both chambers, and never interacted with the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, these kinds of things happen in this relationship. And mm-hmm. There really is like a sadomasochist type of tension here between the two. And of course, it goes to show it's, you know, pedo land and Epstein Island here. So that's, I think, very, very important to understand and recognize here, that these two countries, on the surface, they have one type of relationship. Below, they have also another type of relationship. And there's a lot of gray in between. And we know, you know, Maryam Adelson being unwilling to proclaim her loyalty to the U.S. Is the U.S. number one for you or Israel? And she didn't answer. And people took that as an answer itself.
Exactly. Well, Bibi responded. And I want you and the viewers to tell me what you think of this response.
נשיא טראמפ אמר מוקדם יותר בריאיון לתיים, ישראל לא תספח את הגדה המערבית, כי אני נתתי את מילתי למדינות ערב. הוא אמר, אם נעשה את זה, נאבד את התמיכה האמריקאית. האם האמריקאים מכתיבים עכשיו מדיניות לישראל? מה תגובתך?
זה הרי תמיד תגידו, זה לא משנה. אני מאוד מאוד מעריך את התמיכה של הנשיא טראמפ, גם במהלכי המלחמה, גם בהחלטה שלי להיכנס לעיר עזה, גם בגיוס שלו של העולם הערבי, כדי לחלץ את ה... להוציא את החטופים שלנו בלחץ צבאי שלנו, בלחץ מדיני שלו. והבאנו את 20 החטופים החיים, דבר שאף אחד לא האמין שיהיה. ועכשיו במעמד שאנחנו עושים, קודם בשיחה הערב עם מרקו רוביו, וקודם לכן עם סגן נשיא ונץ, כדי לקדם את היעדים של פירוז עזה ופירוג החמאס מנשקו ועוד דברים חשובים לנו. אז זה מה שחשוב, אני חושב שמה שאתה רואה של שיתוף הפעולה בינינו,
I think Israel, or at least Bibi, is trying to stress that these are two separate things. You're helping us with Gaza and you're backing us up on that. We are an independent nation. We're going to do what we want in West Bank.
Correct.
That's the vibe I'm getting. I don't know.
You know, I think it's even more dark. I think this is more of a one-way relationship than a two-way relationship. We keep taking, and you can't stop because, of course, we have so many weapons in our arsenal for that. Never mind, you know, the claims of whatever they're going to say about anti-Semitism, this, that, the other, but also other tools at their disposal. And on top of that, you're gonna take it. I think a lot of this is theater, like when Trump gets angry with Netanyahu. And I think one of the biggest debates on X, and you've been a part of it, I've been a part of it, many of us, who's pulling whose strings? Who's actually in charge, right? And it's so hard to know because sometimes you think one way, sometimes you think another. But one thing is certain, Israel as a separate entity is much more rogue and belligerent than we think. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of people let on to. And I think that actually it goes against U.S. interests on many different issues and actually causes a lot of need for damage control. And of course, if Netanyahu is proclaiming we're an independent nation, stop taking our tax dollars. Please.
Never!
Please. Stop taking our tax dollars, our weapons, everything. You can stop. Canceled. Cancel the deals.
I agree.
Tariffs on Israel.
I agree with everything that you said. I think it could even be theater for Trump to be like, well, we didn't. We said they couldn't annex West Bank and they did it anyway.
Right.
Like all kind of knowing, you know, or it could also just be Bibi saying, I've got you in a corner anyway. You promised your people you would not put boots on the ground anywhere in Palestine except for the CMCC. I'm just going to walk into West Bank. What are you going to do?
By the way, I want to say, I think you're onto something here. Why? Because of the recent revelations we'll get to a little bit later. And we know that in the recent revelations, in the beginning, it was denial. Then it was, actually, I knew. And now it is, I was actually involved. So there's a lot of psychological warfare going on as well. And I think that this is also part of the plan as well. So get ready, put your tinfoil hats on because DDG conspiracy hour is back.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's coming.
But And speaking of which, so we'll get more into this as well later, but if you've noticed, the influencers are out in full force. Tommy Robinson was in Israel. I don't know if he still is, but this is the same guy that sat down with Tommy Robinson. I believe he's head of settlers in Hebron. And he's the one who sat down with Tommy Robinson and said, we used to love the British, but now they have a special place in hell. Here's his opinion on the vote.
I want to continue this conversation now with another voice, Yishai Fleischer, the spokesperson from the Jewish community in Hebron. And Yishai, you heard from Mark Zell there. He said that this move was bad timing. But for proponents of Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank, is it worth offending U.S. officials and losing U.S. support by actually moving forward with a bill like this?
Yeah, I was a little surprised at J.D. Vance's tone and his choice of words. I would have said to him, this was not meant to offend you. This was not meant to really, it's not in conversation with you. The Jewish people have yearned to be sovereign in Judea and Samaria for a long time. We had a very tough war now. We want to come out with some victories from this war. We want to see more control. We want to push back on jihadism. We want to be sovereign in our land because of our history, because of our rights under international law, which actually the previous Trump administration recognized. So we're moving forward with that. And our Knesset, which is our democratically elected body, our parliament, took a step. It was not timed to be in lockstep with the J.D. Vance visit. It had nothing to do with him. It had something to do with a will of a lot of people in Israel to be sovereign in Judea and Samaria. And it happened to be in his timing. And I was a little bit, I thought it was a kind of strange that he would say that it was personally offensive and that he would say it was stupid. I don't think that was their good choice of wordage. I don't think that was good language to use when dealing with a large swath of the Israeli public, which actually does want to see sovereignty in Judea and Samaria.
No.
This idea that this might derail the peace deal, for God's sakes, what are we talking about here? We're talking about our enemies, Qatar and Turkey, having control in Gaza. That is not the victory that we were promised. We were promised no jihadism, not an Erdogan who just the other day said that he wants to see the destruction of Israel, not Qatar, who is a financier of Hamas. Like, can somebody out here say the emperor is not wearing any clothing? This is not a peace deal. This is jihadism. And even today it's been reported on I-24 in Hebrew that Hamas is probably going to stay in power. This is not victory. This is not a peace deal.
I think it's pretty clear the Israeli opinion of the peace deal and B, whether or not they're going to go into West Bank. And he does kind of have a point. Why? I don't care. Why are you personally offended? This has nothing to do with you.
That is their perspective, is that, you know, it's our decision, except that the United States is paying the price for it, also in its strategic position in the region, also in its strategic interest. Let's think about it this way. If Israel goes forward with annexation, I would hypothesize, here comes the cap, I would hypothesize that there will be a military response by the resistance to that. And it might not only be against the Zionist regime. It could be against American interests in the region and vital economic interests in the region. So once again, we're going to see Red Sea, Strait of Hormuz, yeah, Saudi oil, petroleum in other parts of the Gulf states. We're going to see rocket attacks again, possible, hypersonics. But the main thing is that the Americans know that they're in a very delicate situation here, and they have a big predicament, because if Israel remains belligerent, they undo all of their diplomatic relations with a lot of the GCC members that are actually critical to hold the U.S. position in the region, especially if they want to have a coalition of the willing against Iran. Now, Iran, and of course the axis of resistance, has much more credibility in the eyes of even people who don't necessarily agree with them for their support, unwavering support, and their militant stance. And I think that poses an enormous risk to U.S. personnel and assets in the region. And I think that that's part of the calculus here.
I do like that the first question she asked was it worth offending the Americans? And his response was, yeah, And not only that, but I'm almost offended that you're offended.
Yeah.
I think that people need to pay attention to this stuff. The account that I showed it from InfoLib News is a great one because he pulls a lot of clips that maybe people are missing. And so if you guys want to follow him on Twitter, that's a great account to follow. Also want to make a note that the E1 project of the most of the huge annexation was approved. It got the green light. So, I mean, and that was back in September. So it's like these conversations were kind of already had and were not pushed back upon. So I kind of want to go with the former thing that we said where the Americans are kind of just pretending like we said no and they did it anyway, because we know West Bank annexation is a huge thing for the Kushners and the Adelsons, and they are the funders. So.
Oh, for sure. But I always try to think about like their deep financial ties with the GCC countries. And I'm wondering, I mean, the other layer to this that is a possibility, once again, the cap. Do you remember the big debate of whether Qatar knew about the incoming Israeli strike on Hamas? And we had the big debate on the spaces. And there was a person who was like, I know the Qataris and they would never do that. I am of the opinion that they might have known and they might have let it happen. And there might be a divide. Here I want to think about this in layers. The ruling class of the GCC countries, I honestly don't think they give a shit about the Palestinians.
I don't either.
I think they care about money, power, and their stability. They're concerned about their population.
That's exactly. They're concerned about the uprising. Yeah.
They're concerned about a possible uprising in defense of the Palestinians.
Correct.
And so their big fear, and some of them, I don't even think would care if Al-Aqsa was destroyed or and anything like that. I don't think so. I think that some of them are so perverse in this type of thinking that they are willing to sell the Palestinians out in a way that gives them cover and doesn't lead to unrest within their countries. I think we have to think about that more. I really do.
I agree. Trump also, I do want to play this clip. So this is another thing that I think that this is another potential, maybe you need your tinfoil hat. I don't know.
Two quick questions. Back to the ballroom. It is a very spectacular ballroom, according to the renderings. And if it's half as nice as the one in Mar-a-Lago, then future presidents are really going to appreciate it.
They will. Thank you, Jake.
First of all, is there like an official name? Like, are we calling it the Trump Ballroom, or does the president have a vision for what the name for the ballroom is going to be?
There will be an official name. I will let the president announce that once he firmly decides on it.
And my second question is, looking at these renderings, and it kind of got me thinking, he's likely going to go down as the greatest builder of this era. And you've been in on a lot of those meetings with him. Has, to your knowledge, has the subject of rebuilding the Holy Temple in Jerusalem come up?
It has not. No. It has not. I don't. I'm sorry, Jake.
I keep telling you. I keep telling you. They do this with things. They did this with the red heifer. Now they're doing it with the vote. They say things like, we were doing it as practice. It wasn't really true. We were doing it ceremoniously. This is all part of that.
This is a deeply concerning thing. We've made mention of this numerous times over the past few years, but people should know, especially after October 7th, a lot of IDF soldiers were wearing military patches on their official IDF uniforms of the temple, of a sort of like rebuild the temple movement, of the Greater Israel project, and an expanded map of Israel. And I think that we really have to understand that there is a major political, social, and cultural current that is prepared to do this, that is raising money for it, and that sees Trump as the new Cyrus.
Thank you. I was so glad you brought that up.
And by the way, they said this during his first administration, when he gave sovereignty over the Golan Heights, when he moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now they're really saying, finish the job. Mm-hmm. You know, they left that line, finish the job. Mm-hmm. And what is it? What did he say? To go down as the greatest builder of history, right? In history, of this era of history, and rebuild the holy temple in Jerusalem.
Right. And all you have to do is put that idea in Trump's head. Don't you want to be the greatest builder since Cyrus the Great?
Don't you want to be a new Solomon? We're going to write poetry about you. We're going to talk about about women's breasts and grapes and the glory of Trump. He loves it. Why not? Yep. The wisdom.
Exactly. I mean, when you're that rich and powerful, what do you want? You want your legacy.
It's crazy. But I want people to know there is an actual political movement for this, and it's gaining steam. It might not seem like it's gaining steam, but it is gaining steam. And how do you know it's gaining steam? Everybody's touching that wall now.
Oh, yeah.
That wall more now than at any time before.
Oh, yeah. That's so, so important to say that. The influencers, the politicians, the Trump family, everybody's constantly going to that wall. I have never seen this many visits and this much time spent in Israel. It's truly incredible. I brought up the Red Heifer thing. That happened either in August or September. And I remember when it happened because I have only recently started to get into the wee-woo stuff. For the first 2 years or a year and a half, I was like, don't talk to me about red heifers or temples. Like, just stop. And then they bombed or they burned the cow. And then whoever was, I think Adam King, somebody was running around with the ashes. Well, I found a Jewish, I wouldn't call him a friend, but a Jewish associate. And I asked him straight up, because everybody was saying, oh, it's just practice run, and blah, blah. He said, no, they really did it. They're just saying it was a practice run. And they do the same thing with the Greater Israel Project. They tell you it's just symbology. It's just a symbol. It's just a historical symbol. We're not planning on really doing that. This is all stuff that they put out in the open and then tell you, like, and then they did it with the Knesset vote with the West Bank. And that's why I harped on it so much, because it reminded me of those other times when they did something and then we're like, we were just kidding. It was just theater. It was just a stunt. It was just practice, or we didn't do it right. Or it's really scary. It's getting to the point where it's frightening, because they're going to do whatever they want.
Absolutely. And to go, and I don't know if we're going to play the clip. I don't think so, but I didn't see it in here. But you remember the minister we saw this week talking about?
I got it.
We'll play it.
You know it. Yeah, of course.
I'll save it for then.
But first, before we get to that, Trump did do a Time Magazine interview. I encourage you guys to go read all of it, but I'm just going to point out a few things that I thought were interesting. If you can read it. But so I highlighted some of the important stuff. So right now, this is a quote, right now they're killing gangs that we're sort of finding out. So this is Trump once again admitting that he knows Hamas is cleaning up gangs in Gaza, therefore not breaking the ceasefire, not killing civilians. Okay. Another quote, You know, I stopped him because he would have just kept going. Okay. Bibi literally did keep going and he's still bombing Lebanon. He says, I actually told the emir that this was one of the things that brought us all together. And he's saying that Israel bombing Qatar was good because it brought everybody together in the end. It's really incredible. But the most important part of the interview, and again, I want your opinion and the opinion of the viewers, he admits he was in on the pager attack.
Yep.
I mean, and you know, all of those attacks were done in auspices with me directly, you know, with Israel doing the attacks with the pagers and all that stuff. So they had a look, Israel's been very respectful of this country and they let me know everything. And sometimes I'd say no, and they'd be respectful of that.
I'm curious as to what the no cases were. Because
you're a lawyer. Isn't this illegal? Isn't this a Logan Act violation?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we first and foremost, the United States is implicating itself in war crimes. 100%.
Crazy.
American leadership had knowledge of it. Probably, I mean, the full extent we don't know, but I would venture to guess the United States helped plan, coordinate, provide intelligence and resources.
I said the same thing. I said they at least helped with logistics. If you look at where the pagers came from and like who was involved, I'm like, look, it was literally South Korea, Taiwan, Hungary, Bulgaria. Like, obviously, the United States was involved.
The United States was involved, for sure.
Not only that, everybody said, oh, Bibi gave Trump that pager, that golden pager as a threat. Are you out of your mind? He gave that as a commemoration of our achievement together. Like, what? Come on now.
Great military statesman of this era.
It's getting worse.
It's getting much worse out and there.
Here comes more black pillage. This is what Chris was talking about earlier. This is the Kufi Conference, Christians United Friends of Israel or something like that.
Chosen and still cherished. Deuteronomy 7:6, for you, Israel, are a chosen people, a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself. Listen to this next sentence. A special treasure above all the people on the face of the earth. That includes the United States of America.
But wait, there's more.
Those who hate Israel hate America. Those who hate Jews hate Christians. There is a reason the Ayatollah refers to Israel as the little Satan and America as the great Satan. Every year, the United States provides roughly $3 billion in military assistance to Israel. The benefit we get from that, the Mossad, the intelligence resources. You look at Iran, where they knew where every anti-aircraft weapon was, every military leader, every IRGC leader. That benefit, if America tried to replicate that intelligence network, it would cost us tens of billions of dollars. And I will tell you, every lunatic terrorist in Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran that Israel took out, made America safer, and the United States of America should say to that little nation, thank you, thank you, thank you. That's why, as a matter of public policy, we should support Israel.
Trump is a pedophile!
But I want to close with this. God bless you, son.
I would have cut
Trump is a pedophile.
I would have cut the clip down, but I left that for you because you're the Epstein Files guy.
I am. I am.
These people are lunatics!
Okay, now we're going to get into Christian sectarianism because I am ultimately sectarian myself. I can't hide it anymore. For an Orthodox Christian and even a Catholic, that interpretation is flat out theologically unjustifiable in the Christian tradition. Why? How can you reconcile Deuteronomy with the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and then St. Paul in Galatians writing, for there is neither Jew nor Greek, woman, man, slave, or free, all are one in Christ. This was the big debate of the early church over the sort of much more messianic Jewish strain and the sort of Hellenized Jewish strain. And the emergence of these early meetings and this early council in Jerusalem that was said to take place, where finally it said, we no longer have to keep to the law. We no longer have to have men circumcised. We no longer have to do kosher. That's why Christians can eat pork. That's why Christians can eat shellfish. That's why Christians don't have to get circumcised. So there is no Judeo-Christianity. Because the temple veil was torn in two, I'll destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. That became Christ's body, that became all of creation. And so theologically, it just makes absolutely no sense. In fact, if I'm going to be honest, as a graduate of Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology, 2 master's degrees, and doing some coursework at Harvard Divinity School, I would say this is a heretical movement within contemporary Christianity. It is heretical because it has no basis and foundation in historical Christianity. It's completely outside of a proper understanding of Trinitarian theology and the actual eschatological view of the church in history. And ultimately, I don't even know how you could think about the early church, even Saint Cyprian's statement of extra ecclesiam nulla salus in Latin, outside the church, there is no salvation. Well, Jews are outside the church. Therefore, there is, like, it just doesn't make any sense. I'm going crazy here thinking about it. But you see, it's very convenient to come up with Judeo-Christianity because it ultimately has nothing to do about religion. It's ultimately a political movement. It's a political movement that strengthens the ties between a big imperial power and a colonial outpost, or as Ayatollah says, the great Satan and the little Satan.
Archbishop Atala of the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem says,
"My man,
yep,
my man."
This is his quote for you. I should have uploaded the picture because it's great. But we do not recognize what is called Christian Zionism. This term does not exist in the Christian literature or ecclesiastical lexicon. The blending of Christianity and Zionism is entirely condemned and rejected by us, especially as Christianity is a religion of love, mercy, brotherhood, and peace.
Absolutely. And for all the ortho bros out there and gals, Patriarch Theophilus III of Jerusalem is Patriarch of Jerusalem and all Palestine and the Holy Land, right? And this term, this idea, Israel is no longer a political or geographic entity. It is the entire church. The church is New Israel, mm-hmm. right? So even Christians themselves, especially Orthodox Christians and Eastern Catholics, especially in the Holy Land, they do not acknowledge any connection between political Israel, what is 48 Israel, and the biblical Israel. Completely different. Completely. Like light and dark. You know, completely opposites. There's no connection. These pastors try to make the connection because it helps to solidify their power and base of support, but it has no roots in Christian theology at all. And I would like anyone to come at me and fight me. I'll throw you the patristic Greek and the Latin. We'll get into exegesis and do our hermeneutics. But ultimately, there's nothing to it. And I don't want to get on sidetrack, but let's be honest. The early church was very antagonistic to the Jewish community because of a lot of these internal debates that were going on for the first few centuries within Christianity.
Well, moving on. Not completely, but last part in the Israel taking over the world segment is, I did a thread on Islamophobia and these key findings of this study, if I could get my screen to share. There we go. So I cut this down to size. I was going to give you guys death by PowerPoint, but I'm going to go through this as quickly as possible. If you guys see in there, I did do a thread to explain, the details of it, but I did break down this Lee study from Stagwell. It's one of the top U.S. political consulting firms. It's the same type that works on American elections and global campaigns. They ran a multi-country research project testing how different messages about the Gaza war impacted public opinion of Israel. This report came out in July and I was reported on in September by DropSite, but I want to bring it up again because of what's going on social media, especially. So their key findings. So if you look, they found that these are all pretty surprising, even to me. attitudes towards Israel and the conflict are worse in Europe than in the United States, particularly in the UK, France, and especially Spain. Most Europeans support the Palestinians, except in Germany. Now, I think I want to point out that that might even be because of the Syrian refugees that do not like Palestinians. So keep that in mind as well. Anyway, so over Israel, but they do recoil against both Hamas and Iran. That's important. Again, they're reiterating that the Gen Z is the biggest problem. They are calling them the worst performing group. Nearly half or more of all Europeans believe Palestinians were there first.
Yes.
I thought that was really interesting. This is the important part, what they found in the study. Fear of the threat of Islamic jihadism is prevalent throughout Europe. This is what they really, really wanted to find. So Europeans also believe, they believe what Israel calls the Hamas casualty numbers. They believe they're accurate and that mostly civilians were killed and Israel's language is genocidal. Again, they reiterate the notion of radical jihadism was universally effective and for conservative audiences, connecting radical jihadism to a desire to dominate other religions was effective. If you guys, I'm not going to go through and give you death by PowerPoint, but if you guys go through this study on your own, you might actually be surprised at people's opinions and the favorability. I didn't realize the PR was this bad. 72% in Spain unfavorable towards Israel.
Bomba.
Yeah. Like that's crazy. 58% in France. So, and then it's interesting. They do differentiate between the people and the state, which I thought was interesting. And then look at how low. No majority felt unfavorable towards the Palestinians. So again, they went across the board. Gen Z again performing very badly, according to Israel, and it goes through each country. This is where I wanted to point out. Radical Islam is a threat to my country. This is where they found the hot button issues that they could really get people emotional about, because no longer was saying the victimhood of Jews was not evoking an emotional response from Americans or Europeans for that, for Westerners in general. So they went the route of radical Islam and jihadism, and they found that they could get emotions. And then they started asking, do you think that Palestinians are radicalized? So see, we're making a connection here.
Yep.
Okay. But then they said, most said that they believe Hamas's numbers and that they're very high. They're higher than probably what they said. And that Israel is mostly killing civilians. Everyone agrees on that. They also agree that Israel is systematically oppressing Palestinians and that they do live in an apartheid state, but no majority agree that Israel must be wiped off the earth. And this is important as well. Israel is committing war crimes. Israel is committing genocide. Israel is committing ethnic cleansing. Everybody agreed to that except for the Americans, who were in the minority for two of them. They then again looked at which messaging, and you guys can go read these yourselves, but they're all anti, mostly stressing that Palestinians are radicalized, Hamas controls Palestine, et cetera, et cetera. They looked to see which messaging was most effective. And this is the most important part, is that using that sort of messaging and anti-Islam and fomenting fear of radical jihadism, they found that there was a 27 point swing in positive attitudes towards Israel. So if you're noticing a huge uptick in the Islamophobia online, I guess we'll call it, this is why. That's because it. They found that we can't garner sympathy for the Israelis. And if you go through the study, it asks a lot of questions about the Holocaust. And the opinions weren't like negative or Holocaust denial, but it wasn't sympathy. It wasn't an outpouring of sympathy. So they went on, started asking about radical Islam. And then it's when they found, if we can use this instead. So that's why we're seeing this incredible uptick about, I've been hearing about Sharia law. I call it Shakira law, but Shakira. I've heard about Shakira law for the entire weekend. That's all people were talking about in spaces. It was nuts. And I was like, why are these people talking about Sharia law? Then I started hearing Americans saying taqiyya. And I was like, oh dear, they've learned the word taquilla, but none of them knew even how to use it correctly. I don't know how to use it correctly either, so I won't attempt to. But I was like, okay, this is really getting weird. Where is this all coming from? And we know that these things take months to kind of get into effect, or for us to at least start seeing the tangible effects of it. And I think this is coming from that report, is where it says it's easier just to say Muslims are bad, therefore Israel is somewhat good, than to say Israel's actually good.
Absolutely. So you're seeing the uptick with Valentina, right? Mm-hmm. Gomez there, right? Tommy Robinson. You're seeing all of these, influencers, right? The Jewish American princesses. They love to call themselves that. So it's their identity. I'm not going to say
slur.
Not a slur. Sorry. And then you have a growing coalition. By the way, you have a growing number of Emirati and sort of GCC influencers who are also feeding into this. Like, we need to ban the Muslim Brotherhood, and we need to, you know, go after these radical Muslims and things like that. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, aren't you all still wearing the niqab out there too? You know, I mean, I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on. But this trajectory is really having a material impact, because instead of talking about dead children and a genocidal army displacing a indigenous population, now you're saying all these people are coming in Europe and they're going to destroy our churches and burn them down, and they're raping our women, and oh my God, bloodline, and Muslim New World Order or some BS like that you keep seeing, right? And it preys on a lot of the fears and, you know, Orientalist fantasies of people in the West. And I think that has very potent energy. And that's where they're getting. We're back, like we've been saying, we're back in 2002, 2003. Really, we're there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Again, I still can't get a falafel. I have to drive 2 hours for falafel. So I'm still waiting for the Shakira law wave to get out here. Anyway, moving to another continent, just like the USS Ford. Colombia. I love
speaking
Petro.
Of Shakira La.
Speaking of Shakira La, off to Colombia. Vamos a Colombia. On Thursday, Caroline Levitt announced in a presser that there would be no de-escalation in regard to Colombia, and particularly on President Gustavo Petro, who they are calling a lunatic, which, you know what? He's a lunatic. I'll take it, but he's a lunatic in the best way.
He's our lunatic.
He's not violent. That's good, right? He was added to the sanctions list on Friday, the OFAC sanctions list. He did respond. Let me get that response, of course, in his way, in Petro's wonderful way.
Si logran vencer este gobierno, si logran arrodillar este gobierno, si logran silenciar mi voz, si logran silenciar la bandera que hemos levantado, yo me atrevo a decir... Nosotros no nos arrodillamos. Nosotros no vamos a dar un paso atrás. Me decía aquí un congresista bastante corto en ideas de los Estados Unidos en español, Jiménez se llama, que ahora sí iba a entender porque me metieron en la lista de los FAC, que había que cambiar de posición. Y yo le estaba contestando, aún no le he mandado la respuesta. Yo nunca he cedido a propuestas mafiosas. Para mí, ese tipo de actitudes no son más, sino la expresión típica de la mafia colombiana durmiendo en Miami con sus aliados de la extrema derecha en la Florida, tratando de arrodillar un presidente porque no le van a dejar hacer negocios en los Estados Unidos. O quizás en ninguna parte del mundo. Pero si yo no he hecho negocios nunca. No tengo un dólar en los Estados Unidos. No hay ninguna cuenta que congelarme. No tengo ni ganas ni nunca en el futuro de hacer negocios en los Estados Unidos de Norteamérica.
Applauded for like a minute, but he is doing business in the United States. Our good friend Dan is now his lawyer, and we will have Dan on Wednesday to tell us about it. But you were in Venezuela, and before we talk about Venezuela, was there any Colombia, any vibes or talk about Colombia?
Absolutely. President Maduro and all the activists there and the community leaders and the commune leaders and the military spoke about the Gran Patria, right? And of course, it's very important because this is Bolivar's vision, right? And so Colombia and Venezuela both have the same liberator, both have the same tradition, and both see themselves now as united against U.S. aggression. And so when President Maduro spoke, he said, Venezuelans with Colombians, Colombians with Venezuelans, all children of Simon Bolivar, and all will fight for the dignity of the Caribbean and Latin America. And it was powerful, like a bomb.
These leaders get me so hype. I can't watch like too much of Petro or Maduro. They get me more hype than any other leaders. It's too much.
It's great. They're,
that's all the spitting and the yelling, I think. Anyway, let's move on to Venezuela so I can... We've been 90 minutes. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Okay, on Venezuela, or on Wednesday while Ruth was in town, Trump did talk about Venezuela in front of me. He had this to say about killing people in the Caribbean.
And the only way you can't feel bad about it is you realize that you won't feel badly about it, is you realize that every time you see that happen, you're saving 25,000 American lives. Every one of those boats that gets knocked out is saving 25,000 American lives, not to mention the torn up families all over the country.
I don't know where he got that statistic from, but I also also on Wednesday, I don't know if you guys remember, I'm pretty sure it was while we were streaming, but there were B-1 bombers. I messaged you. I was like, we're going to bomb Venezuela. There were B-1 bombers, all kinds of aircraft heading in that direction. Some even entered Venezuelan airspace, I believe, and their Venezuelan jets scrambled as well, didn't they?
I heard jets overhead. All of a sudden, I get these messages, and all of a sudden, I start hearing these zooming noises over the Capitol. I'm like, what's going on up there? Like they're breaking the sound barrier or something. And they were Venezuelan jets scrambling. So Venezuelan Air Force is ready. They're ready. Defense is ready.
This is what Trump had to say.
If I could just ask both of you, including Secretary Hegseth, there's reporting the U.S. just sent B-1 bombers near Venezuela to ramp up some military pressure there. Is that accurate? And can you tell us more about that mission?
No, it's not accurate. No, it's false. But we're not happy with Venezuela for a lot of reasons, drugs being one of them. But also they've been sending their prisoners into our country for.
They weren't there. We watched them. I watched the bombers on radar.
Right. They were on radar.
Why do you think he lied?
Listen, I mean, this is all part of, he lied the same about some of the other operations we were talking about earlier. I think it's all part of this game, you know, sort of psychological warfare kind of game. We didn't do anything, but actually we did do something. And maybe it's to kind of psych the Venezuelans out, because they're monitoring everything, right? They're watching what he's saying. They're watching what he's doing. Or he could just be out of the loop, but I don't believe that at all.
Didn't know it all.
I don't believe he's out of the loop at all on this issue.
Well, we've repeatedly said that the war on terror and the war on drugs were going to combine. I want you guys to keep in mind that the reason why we're flooded with fentanyl is because of the failure in Afghanistan, the failure over there, after the Taliban was rightfully put back into power, they eradicated the poppy fields. But the United States and Big Pharma had already gotten the population addicted to opiates. So the poppy fields are gone, and the Taliban isn't supplying that anymore. The other markets are much, much smaller and can't supply the demand. And so synthetic heroin becomes, or morphine or whatever it is, fentanyl becomes popular.
Yep.
I mean, this is our own fault. So we had a population that was addicted to opiates because there was a morphine heroin boom because you were running the poppy fields in Afghanistan. When that fell apart, you had a population going through withdrawal looking for opiates.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
And it's not even that the fentanyl is coming in made. How I understand it is that the raw materials come in and then it's made here, or it's made in Mexico. It's made in Mexico or Canada and kind of pushed over the border.
It's right in the neighborhood, on both sides of the border. It's right there. Why would they be making it in Venezuela and shipping it? This doesn't make sense.
They're not even doing that. Listen to what Trump said.
Since it mostly comes from China and has caused such carnage in the U.S., what are you going to say to convey the seriousness? And also a second question for you or Secretary Hegseth. Is there any evidence that China is now smuggling fentanyl through Venezuela to bypass U.S. and Mexican port controls?
They are doing that, yes. But they are paying right now a 20% tariff because of fentanyl. That's billions and billions of dollars that they're paying.
China's bringing it in through Venezuela.
It's never ending, you know.
But my hips don't lie. Look, this is where the fentanyl really comes from. The southwestern border.
Absolutely.
It's coming from, and this is literally at this same meeting where Trump's talking about this. This was this weird powwow he had with all of the influencer cabinet members, Pete Hegseth, Tulsi was there, Noam, all of them. And Pete Hegseth said verbatim, he used the word, the southwestern border is locked down. This is such a narrative they're trying to build. We've got, it used to come in on the southwest border, but we've got total control over that. It's completely locked down. It's now all coming from Venezuela.
Total control.
This is bonkers.
Just like the wall was built. Total control.
We have some wall, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, we have some wall, but not full wall. And actually, people just cut holes in the wall. Because you know as well as I do that security like that is not possible 100%.
Well, no. I mean, it's not.
No.
Anyway, also announced this week, it's not funny. USS Ford, which, all right, I have a bone to pick with the people on the Ford. Like, F you. I never got port visits like this. These jerks have been to Oslo. Then they were like, all right, we're going to go over to the Mediterranean. They did a port visit in Croatia, and now they're being told they're going all the way down to Venezuela. Could these people get better port visits? They're probably going to stop in Brazil. They're probably going to get to go to the Florida Keys. Like, this is literally like a carnival cruise. Anyway, the USS Ford Carrier Strike Group is going down to Southcom. This is unprecedented. We have never, I looked and looked and looked because I couldn't think of any. And so I was like, before I say this, I want to be sure. I couldn't find an instance of a carrier strike group ever applying or ever deploying to this, to Southcom in a wartime or a fighter posture.
It's very, very interesting. Very interesting development. I would, as an aside, because, you know, we're old military, you know, people, I would say, what's the STD rate on the Ford before and after ports of call? There are statistics about this. So just throwing that out there.
They just left Croatia and they're headed down. They should be there about 12 days, most likely. But who knows what the mission does? I have no idea. Was the carrier goes for one reason only: to project power and to launch flight ops.
Was there no aircraft carrier used in Grenada or in Panama?
No, those were probably amphibious landing ships because it was Marines.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to look at. You rarely, if ever, hear about... I mean, I've never heard about aircraft carriers in the Caribbean.
I've never heard of it either.
You know,
in a military, like
military sense.
Yeah, in an offensive posture. No, I've never seen anything like this. There's been exercises, of course.
Yeah, exercises happen, of course. I mean, and also ports of call along the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America or whatever Gulf you want to call it, and the eastern seaboard. But I like this. I haven't seen that. When Trump was threatening Venezuela in 2019, I don't think that there was a deployment of carrier strike groups to the Caribbean. That's a new development.
Also something to look into. At the end of Trump's last term, he did sign some weird law or executive order that barred Venezuelans from being deported or prosecuted in the United States.
Yes, and I believe that he annulled that rule when he came into office this time around because a lot of people were deported. That's been part of the issues that we've been dealing with down there with Alex Saab, Camila Fabris Saab, his wife, and everybody, because there's been like families separated, people going to El Salvador. It's been, you know, the gangs that they're saying they belong to. So yeah, they've abrogated that rule, as far as I know.
The defense minister with the baddest name in the world, I mean bad as in like amazing, Vladimir Padrino Lopez, had this to say about the CIA in Venezuela.
Sabemos que la CIA, bueno, está allí presente no solamente en Venezuela, sino en todas partes del mundo donde no haya embajada. Donde hay una embajada, mejor dicho, de los Estados Unidos, allá estará operando la CIA. Así que bueno, desde aquí nosotros con humildad decimos todas las acciones que estamos haciendo, repito, para alcanzar un punto óptimo para evitar y contrarrestar la amenaza militar desplegada en el Caribe, grosera amenaza militar contra la región y además para proteger internamente de cualquier acto de desestabilización al país. Y lo vamos a hacer con mucha fuerza.
Did you notice heightened security while you were there? Were people on edge or?
There was, of course, an increase in police and military presence and checkpoints and things like that. But life was very normal and good times, as always.
Well, speaking of good times, here's the clip from your trip. We'll get to the happy stuff.
Greetings, everyone. So I'm here in a rural commune here outside of Caracas. We just got to listen to about a two-hour speech from President Nicolas Maduro. It was amazing, really, really powerful, impactful, a call for peace, a call for prosperity across Latin America, a call against war and against militarization in the Caribbean and throughout the continent. And I think it's very important that there was such a big presence of the local people here, a lot of peasants. There was the creation of a National Peasants Union just a few weeks ago. And of course, here was showcasing all of the domestic agricultural production so that Venezuela can maintain its independence, its sovereignty, and the ability to have its own products without the need of relying on the West and other countries for imports of agricultural products. Venezuela is now self-sufficient. So one of the big things today that President Nicolas Maduro said was that he was a cadet of the people, that he is a student of the people, and ultimately that the people here demand peace and demand a prosperous life. And that is what the government continues to provide and to try to instill amongst its leadership and amongst all of the sectors of the economy and the government. And an important thing was I had a chance to shake his hand and say that the people of the United States want peace with Venezuela. And he looked at me and said, "Verdad." And that is the truth. And he knows that the people of the United States do not want perpetual and endless war. They want peace. And ultimately, we will continue to fight for that peace and against endless wars and the regime change that has brought so much death and destruction to so many countries around the world.
You got to see Maduro.
I did. Woo!
Vladimir Lopez. How was it? Tell us all about it.
No, it was great. It was absolutely fantastic. It was a great time. I do have to say, and I announced it on my X as well, President Maduro has called for the creation of an international brigades with the name of Simon Bolivar. And so he's looking to Spain and the fight against fascism in Spain, the fight against Franco, the defense of the Republic as being also the defense of Venezuela at this point from U.S. imperialism. I thought it was an amazing opportunity to speak about that. And, you know, he got to address our cohort there and to basically say Venezuela is open to all internationalists who want to come and defend the Venezuelan people, their sovereignty and their independence and their Bolivarian revolution, right? Socialism in the 21st century. So that was amazing. He was very passionate. You could tell, you know, I was sitting next to a great comrade from Chile. And, you know, there were, of course, I got a little emotional because I had been to Chile just a little over, a little less than a year ago. And seeing, going to Allende's grave, meeting with people who were with Allende at that time, and thinking about, could this be the final days of President Maduro? And thinking about the bombing of the presidential palace in Chile, right, where Allende was, and the American support for that. But President Maduro seemed so strong, and he exuded the confidence that even if I'm killed, the revolution continues. Even if I'm killed, Venezuela remains, and Venezuela is strong because of a proud tradition of those who fought and continue to fight for its sovereignty and independence. So that was very powerful. You could definitely feel those historical connections and that history coming forward. And I think that that was very meaningful. There was a lot of kids there, a lot of young families, a lot of people very much passionate about their country and defending their country. And I hope to go back soon. I hope that we will continue to speak about Venezuela because it is a country that has been in the crosshairs since the 1990s. And of course, is a place that could see escalation at any moment. So we're going to be monitoring it and bringing it to you all. But it was great to be on the ground. And of course, great to greet the president on behalf of everyone.
And the Venezuelan people are the best. We get the best messages from the Venezuelan people thanking us for our coverage. I don't even know if we're doing it right. I'm just winging it. I'm reading my book about Bolivar. I'm trying to learn, but our Venezuelan subscribers and followers have been absolutely amazing. And here's one of my favorites right here, Daniel. Life is normal and getting better. We've passed 1.1 million oil barrels per day, and it shows. That's what we love, love, love to hear.
Absolutely.
Other super chats. Thank you, Nas, for becoming a member. Hummus, as always, will negotiate a ceasefire, enforce international mediation, and address root causes like territorial disputes and security causes, concerns through diplomacy. Easier said than done, but that's the gist. Mm-hmm. Sarah stands up to males online. Idiot men go after ladies like her online. She exhibits moral fortitude to keep going. I don't care about anonymous men on Twitter. If they can't show their faces, then I mean, maybe they should go on RT instead of me. I don't know. Thank you for being our 1,000th subscriber on Insta. You know, we send gifts to our wonderful, wonderful community. When you don't know is how money is created. I don't even know how money is created. I don't know how I really make it through the day. So, but yeah.
That's a big conversation about fiat currency and the creation of money.
I did not know this, but in earlier centuries, usury was considered evil amongst Christians. It still is. And Muslims, it still is. People converted to Judaism to be money lenders. I need to look more into the historical stuff.
There is some truth to that, of course, and the Jewish community was used by different power players because it was allowed. But yeah, it was a particular period in history where that was happening. Some of it, of course, kind of, you know, hysterical and sort of, you know, put out there in the masses to also foment some of the violence against the Jewish community, but also it did happen in many parts of medieval and earlier times, for sure.
And lastly, Nas says, thank you, Chris and Sarah. The world has gone mad and is being run by deluded geriatrics. Yes, but we are here.
We're here.
We're not geriatric yet.
Not yet.
Hopefully you won't see Chris in an international militia in Venezuela in the next couple months. I'm hoping that that's. I went to the first time you said that. I said, oh my God, no. Why did they tell Chris this? I'm going to lose my co-host. I just got this back on track.
Co-host live in Caracas.
Front line in the jungles of Venezuela. Also, as I said a million times, Maduro did say this week, maybe we should ask the United States if they want another war like Vietnam.
Yep, he did say that.
But we'll keep monitoring the situation. Chris is back in Moscow, unfortunately, and our producer is heading to Moscow this week. I am left behind with the dogs once again. But we will see you on Wednesday with Dan Kovalik, the new lawyer for Gustavo Petro.
Let's go.
Also, to the Antifa, you anarchists suck. This is why we hate Antifa. You guys suck. You have no plans, no policy, no ideology, just feelings and angst. Just all feelings, all angst. And some anarchists in the chat is saying Maduro is a fascist.
Maduro's a fascist?
I can't with
They're
these
doing the job for the CIA. They're doing the job for the CIA.
Antifa is CNN. Anyway, if we, this is for another installment of us. If we had to see it, you do too. We're going to leave you with this wonderful, wonderful production by Israeli Channel 12, an ode to our leader and Cyrus the Great, Donald Trump. See you guys on Wednesday.
You comrades.
Hostages back. It took me less time than to cook a Big Mac. Then I said to 10,000 years of war, bye-bye.
זה היה שטאפ של חבר שלי. אמרתי כן שהביא את העליי.
דונלד טראמפ הוא הקיסר של האימפריה.
אין מספיק זמן בפזמון לליקוקים.
Not you again.
הוא יודע אנגלית די מושלם.
אין תותח כזה בעולם.
דונלד טראמפ וגילה גמליאל כשרי האימפריה.
גילה הוא?
עזוב, סתם נדחפה, הנה ציפור, ציפי.
קורח בראש הוא ניסן.
בצבע של תפוגן.
תעשה מה בראש, זה הכל בפינה, לא נמצא ממך כלום.
רק אולי חנינה.
לקטת את הגוף, את התוקים את הפיין.
אם תרצה התעצלות, לג'פר אפשר גם.
הוא משיח, הוא קורא, שום מוער, הוא שם. קבלו.